Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast, providing an exclusive look into efforts to conserve the wild things and wild places in Texas.
I'm Lydia Saldana with Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation. We're here at El Sal's Ranch in South Texas near Port Mansfield with We Will Not Be Tamed ambassador Jordan Shipley and a Texas Monthly video crew. We're about to eavesdrop on an interview conducted by Texas Monthly's Melissa Reese. Let's listen in.
I'm Jordan Shipley. I am just basically an outdoor aholic. I grew up in the football world. My dad's a football coach. Got into the outdoors and then ended up just, you know, any chance I get, it's kind of my release from everything. So I don't know, it's something that connects me to nature and just something I can't get out of my system, I guess.
Can you talk about like what you did today and, you know, if it was unique and new, can you just kind of talk us through that?
Today was something different for me. Normally when it's 110 degrees, you're either, you know, in a swimming pool or you got a fishing pole in your hand or something when you're outside. But we are down on the Texas coast, and there's an animal here called nilgai that some people are familiar with, a lot of people aren't. It's a really big, majestic looking animal, almost the size of an elk. And so we decided it would be kind of fun to try to, you know, do a spot and stalk archery hunt in the middle of the summer and in the dunes down here in South Texas. And it's definitely not something, normally we're not even, you know, I'm practicing a little bit, but we're not doing anything, you know, archery related until October. So definitely something different.
How'd it go?
It's tough. I mean, this is kind of one of those deals where, you know, you have to get it right one time, they have to get it right every time. So there's a lot of times where you know, at the end of an encounter, you kind of look at each other like, well, that was close, but didn't happen. And, you know, so you just got to keep trying and keep learning on the fly and figuring things out. And, you know, we hadn't figured it out yet.
Does it ever get old, the not getting it, or is it sort of like a hook?
The problem is if it happens one time and everything comes together and it plays out just right, it's the kind of feeling that you can't replace. And it's impossible to understand it until you've done it. But I think the reason that it's so rewarding is because most of the time, especially when you're trying to sneak up on an animal like this that's wild, that, you know, there's some of the wildest animals out there, and it's gonna go wrong almost every time. But the one time when it happens just right, you know, you remember it forever, and you can't wait to get back out and do it again.
Can you talk about the role that hunting plays in your life, like now, your current stage of life, like professionally and just sort of, or not professionally?
I think hunting for me, there's a lot of different components to it, you know, and as far as why I do it and what it means to me. I think a lot of it early on was just the relational component, was spending time. There's not a lot, you know, in this day and age, there's not a lot of things that brings a family together, puts, you know, two men together in a situation where they can talk and, you know, there's a reason to just be out kind of away from the world and, you know, getting to know each other better. And for, you know, me and Dad, that was kind of something that we did early on. I think there's that component of it. And I think also there's something to being able to harvest an animal and you know, that provide the meat for your family and yourself, that is again kind of hard to explain, but it's something natural. And it's you know, I compare it to, why do we go to the gym to work out, you know? And it's because we need that physical activity, and we've gotten to a place in our world where we can literally not exert ourselves at all. Our life has gotten to that point. And I think it's the same thing on the hunting. So I could go to the supermarket and get food, but there's a natural desire in me and a natural, you know, instinct to go out and hunt and harvest it myself. And, you know, I don't know. We've gotten to the point where we've gotten away from it, but it's something that I like to do.
Is it something you think, like, when you have kids, you're gonna pass it on, or?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, hunting has been a part of civilization since there was civilization. You know, it's something that I think a lot of us just have built into us, you know, hardwired into our DNA. And and I can't explain it to you other than, you know, having done it, having harvested an animal, and it provided the food for your family, and the and what went into it, and, you know, just the whole process behind it is something that brings families together, and it's something that I learned with my dad and he learned from his dad. And I'm sure if, you know, if we are blessed enough to have kids, that we'll pass that down to them too.
Could you tell us maybe a couple anecdotes, like the, your first hunt or your first kill, or just sort of walk us through what that was like?
Yeah.
Or a memorable one?
You know, hunting to me, probably one of my favorite memories of hunting is one of my biggest influences in the whole outdoor world in general was my grandmother. And I think that's kind of a, it's kind of a fun deal, but I was able to take, I grew up getting to go fishing with her and hunting with her and my granddad, but she loved it as much as anybody, and she wanted to do it as much as anybody. And that for her has not gotten, it's not gone away with time. And she's 83 years old, and I got to take her out 2 years ago. And she took a whitetail buck, and it was just like, people have been telling me, she talks about that every time we see her, you know? And so it's just, for it to mean that much to somebody, especially, you know, a woman in her 80s, I think, you know, that says a lot.
For sure. So can you just talk a little about the passing of the tradition, like how you got hooked through your dad into hunting, and sort of like, sort of maybe other traditions that sort of extend, I guess what I'm trying to get at, just from the back end of what I'm trying to go with, is that there's this idea of conservation, passing it down as a tradition, this sort of resource that we have. And I'm telling you that so that you can absorb it, and then kind of talk a little bit about the tradition that you share with your family, your grandmother, your father, and sort of what that means to you, and how that translates to also the natural resources and, mm-hmm. and things like that.
I think the way that, you know, especially in this state and in our society, hunting and the outdoors is very much a, you know, it's a generational thing that gets passed down. And, you know, you grow up, you know, I was terrible at it when I first started, and I think everybody's terrible at it when they first start, but you learn and you're around it, and something about it just hooks you, and it feels right. And so you learn, and you get to spend time. A lot of people, you know, aren't fortunate to spend time with their families and to spend time with their dads and their granddads, but it's, you know, for us, it was a great excuse for us to all get out together and spend quality time together. And the outdoors was a central part of that, but it was also the relational component. So that was passed down to me. Same thing with my grandparents. That's the time I remember with them is always in the outdoors, because, you know, that's what we did. That was the excuse to get out away from the world and to actually spend time together. And so as much as anything, especially in this day and age where technology is getting so crazy, I mean, it's time to just get out and, you know, be able to breathe some clean air and, you know, enjoy these animals and enjoy, you know, what's out here.
Get that butterfly.
That was
wrong. Kind of cute. But
see, even the butterflies are playing along.
So cute. What similarities or any do you find sort of between your life as a football athlete and as a, like, an outdoorsman and a, you know, an athlete in sort of hunting and fishing capacities?
Yeah, I think there's definitely some correlation between the athletic world and hunting and fishing. A lot of it is just on the mental side, and learning mental toughness and learning, you know, how not to get rattled and how to, you know, not everything's going to work out perfect, and you got to learn through, you know, how to fight through adversity and how to, you know, learn from mistakes that you make and get better the next time. And I think that's life in general, but it really correlates between, you know, football. That's the whole thing, is learning, what did I do wrong this time? You got film review and you figure out how to do it better the next time. Especially archery is the same way. I mean, anybody that's done anything in archery knows that you're going to mess stuff up and you're going to mess stuff up. And then you almost learn by, you know, learning from this mistake and then this mistake and then this mistake. And finally, it kind of comes together and, you know, and you figure it out.
Is there like a particular hunting style that you're attracted to more over another? I know you did the archery today, but there's other stuff I know. And
yeah, I really enjoy a lot of different styles and applications of hunting. I think this is, you know, it's always fun to do something new. So today, this was a blast just because, you know, I was like, okay, the old guy in the middle of summer, 110 degrees, everybody's on the way down here is telling me I'm crazy. But it was so cool seeing those bulls out there in the middle of the meadow and trying to figure out a way to get close to them. I would say probably my favorite is anything that has some physical activity involved in it, just because, you know, at the end of the day, you feel like, you know, whether or not you were successful, it was a successful day because you felt like you did something and you tried and you poured it all out there. And so I really enjoy anything spot and stalk, but I enjoy the other stuff too. It's just almost like there's a time and a season for everything.
For the uninitiated, could you sort of describe what spot and stalk, like what that is?
Yeah. So spot and stalk is basically just a form of hunting where, you know, you're using optics and glassing and trying to find animals and just figure out a way to get close to them. And it's really pretty simple. It's basically just finding them and using any kind of terrain and any kind of habitat and brush to crawl or, you know, squat, and sometimes you can walk, but it's basically just trying to figure out a way to get as close as possible.
What's kind of like, is it like a, I guess I'm trying to ask, is it, what's going through your mind? Is it like a focused activity, or are you absorbing all these inputs, you know, like?
It's really kind of strange, because I think there's times where, you know, you've got tunnel vision and you've got something, you know, kind of in your sights and you're working towards it, but at the same time there's also times when you look up and you're just like, man, this is just amazing. You know, there's a bunch of times today where just looking up and seeing the habitat, and you got oak trees over here and you got sand dunes over here, and it's almost like you got desert meeting almost, you know, rainforest type stuff. So there's a component of both.
Yeah, that was really good. Do you mind, once the truck goes off, kind of re-saying that whole thing? It was really nice, but there was the truck on it.
But Trey totally ruined it. Oh, okay, you're going to have to ask me again.
You're out there and you're in tunnel vision, but you also stop to just describe that in the present moment.
Like. Yeah. I mean, I think there's times when you've got something in your sights and, you know, you kind of have tunnel vision and you're focused on only that and trying to figure out a way, you know, to how can I get as close as I can to this animal. But there's also times when you look up and you just, you know, realize how incredible some of this habitat is. And so it's kind of a combination between tunnel vision and also sitting back and going, man, this is incredible. We've got, you know, in certain areas, you know, motts and rolling country, and then we've got sand dunes, and it's almost like desert meeting rainforest, and you got oak trees and everything else, and just it's an incredible combination of being able to have heightened moments where you're focused and then also just taking it all in at other times.
Awesome. What animal, like, again, I'm interested in sort of like the tools. Like, what kind of animals lend itself well to archery, and what animals lend itself well to other tools, and why would you sort of move between them?
I think a lot of it has to do, you know, as far as archery hunting, some animals are just really difficult to, you know, to hunt because, and more than anything, it's because of the terrain. You know, pronghorn way out in West Texas are going to be extremely difficult to archery hunt just because they're out in the middle of the wide open, you know, and other animals. This actually would work well here where we're at in South Texas doing spot and stalk on these nilgai because, and I probably wouldn't have believed it, but just the habitat lends itself for being able to sneak, and you can get behind a bush and sneak up to it, and then there's another bush and you can kind of figure it out. But other animals are just naturally, you know, whitetail, you pretty much have to hunt them from a stand, you know, and be in a stationary, just very still, very quiet. They're just very alert, very scent sensitive and aware. So some of it depends on where, you know, feral hogs have very poor vision and, you know, they rely more on smell. So you can kind of you get downwind of them and you can sneak up on them a lot easier. So some of it depends on habitat and some of it depends on the animal.
Do you find yourself getting competitive with your own abilities of wanting new challenges or up yourself on what you've been able to do?
I think, yeah, competitiveness sometimes is like a disease for this kind of stuff because you always want to figure out how could I do it better than the time before? What did I do wrong? And you have to sit there and think about it the rest of the day when you had that one opportunity and everything, you know, you worked so hard and you snuck for 2 hours and then you blew it. And so the competitiveness is I think, what drives you to get better, but at the same time, You know, I try not to get so serious about it that I lose sight of the fact that this is just an amazing thing that we have the opportunity to do.
Has that drive ever led you to like a particular adventure or sort of experience that is a little?
Yeah, I think the competitive drive naturally lends itself to pushing the envelope and trying to figure out, you know, that challenge that's just right there on the grasp of what you think you might be capable of. And so for me, I did a couple archery elk hunts that were, I had never done it before, and people, you know, were telling me, oh, my dad's been on 15 or 20 archery elk hunts and hasn't harvested anything yet. And so I wanted to prove it to myself that I could go out there and just, you know, kind of by figuring it out and by willpower, go at it long enough and hard enough to where, you know, I was able to harvest an animal, and it ended up working out. So that was kind of one of those validating moments for me.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the location where we're at and just sort of describe a little bit like you did before, but like sort of the sights and sounds so we can kind of match it with visuals, but also maybe just talk about why this particular location is special or unique?
We're at El Sal's Ranch in South Texas. We're really pretty close to Laguna Madre in South Padre Island, and this is probably the most diverse piece of property that I've ever seen in the state of Texas. It's unbelievable, and I wouldn't have believed it before I came down here, but you've got areas that are, you know, kind of open meadows with motts, and then you've got other areas that are almost solid oak tree cover with some mesquites mixed in, then you've got other swampy areas, and then you've got out of nowhere sand dunes that are probably 60 feet tall, and we saw one today that totally had engulfed a windmill. You know, the windmill last year was not in the sand dune, and this year enough sand has blown into where it's actually in the sand dune. So you can walk off the sand dune and into a tree if you want to, and I've never seen that before in my entire life.
Where do you normally spend your sort of hunting time or your outdoor activity time?
I think one of the cool things about Texas is that, you know, they say it's really seven totally different regions, so that's one of the most fun things about it to me, is you can always find something that's different than a different region. And, you know, East Texas, you kind of got the piney woods. South Texas, you got the brush country, you got the hill country, and then you've got some of that Paladura Canyon stuff up in Northwest Texas, and then you've got the really kind of wide open stuff in West Texas. So I like to kind of bounce around and do different things different years, and kind of really just experience, just like we did today, something new and something different. And then, you know, before long, it's time to revisit something that you did several years ago.
So in what ways, if any, do you sort of personally identify with Texas or the outdoors in Texas?
I think as somebody that grew up in Texas and, you know, has part of a long line of Texans, the outdoors is just something here that it's just a part of our culture for a lot of people. And there's a lot of people coming into Texas now that have never seen that before, and you know, some of them are sometimes skeptical, and then they get to go do it and they realize that we have some incredible resources here. And I think the other thing too is we've got probably one of the best parks and wildlife departments as far as allowing landowners to manage, you know, some of their own deer herds and really work with the landowners. And we've got so much private land here, but to me, that's what's really neat, is to see how serious people in Texas take their outdoor pursuits, and they go to all kinds of extreme lengths to improve their properties and improve their wildlife herds.
If you could just give an overview over the relationship between private lands and public lands and the outdoor activities and sort of those relationships. I don't think everyone quite understands the dependency between private lands and how that works.
Sure. In Texas, I mean, this is a state that has a whole lot of private land, and compared to some of the western states, probably not nearly as much public land, but there, you know, it's something that honestly I didn't know a whole lot about. I'm learning more about some of the public land stuff that's going on and some of the things that Texas Parks and Wildlife is doing in that world to, you know, to kind of foster wildlife and get people out to some of those places. But I think what they've done on the private land side is different than any other state in the country. I think landowners in Texas take it so seriously that the regulations and the management that goes on here and the conservation is something different than any other state that I've ever seen.
Is there something uniquely Texan about hunting?
I think there's definitely something uniquely Texan about certain types of hunting and certain styles. I mean, there is nothing in the world like South Texas. I mean, people talk about it all over the place. I mean, it's the best deer habitat that the world has ever seen. And so I think what has been done as far as, and a lot of that honestly has to do with water and the spread of water and now the way that we can kind of harvest it with windmills and different things, because before there was no, there was along the river basins there were deer, but they couldn't, they couldn't survive out in the middle of the pastures because there was no water for them. So this area and this part of the state is kind of the mecca, I think, for whitetail hunting across the world. So I think whitetail deer, I think there's something about, I mean, whitetail deer are kind of the golden standard for hunting across the country, but nobody takes it more seriously and nobody manages them. And I think a lot of them don't necessarily turn them into Boone and Crockett, but some of the biggest deer in the country are killed in Texas every year.
Is there what idea about any of these topics would you want to share with someone who's watching this video who's not nearly as, ingrained in the culture as you are? What would you want to say?
I think the outdoors is something that you just have to, it's a very hard thing to explain, and it's something that's, you have to experience it to really know it and to really get it and to really understand it. And a lot of people don't understand it, but I think Texas in general has done an outstanding job of kind of getting people out into it and allowing them to experience it. And that in turn passes on to new generations, but it also passes in. We've got a lot of people right now moving into Texas from other places. And so really the outdoors to me is just something that Texas has really taken hold of, and hopefully it'll be that way for a long time to come.
Cool. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, and I know we kind of touched on this a little bit, but could you just kind of describe this situation this morning, like firsthand experience? Maybe say like we woke up at dawn, we set out, and just kind of describe what we did hunting this morning.
Yeah, so it's the middle of July in South Texas, and we got out this morning. I was halfway expecting it to feel like, there was a blow dryer in our face when we got up this morning, but it honestly wasn't too bad. So we decided just basically to go try to spot and stalk Neil Guy, and obviously covered, we're going to cover a lot of country doing that, and there's going to be a lot of areas where you don't see anything, but we happened to stumble upon this one oak mott or meadow out in the middle of a bunch of motts, and looked out there, and there were four really nice mature Neil Guy bulls, and so they were probably 225 yards away, and we just tried our best to spot and stalk and sneak up on them. And like a lot of times it does, we ran out of brush and we probably were 100 something yards away and weren't going to take an unethical shot. But just to get that close to them and to see those animals out there and the way that they move and the way that they graze, it was a pretty fun morning.
Yeah, and it's kind of, like you were saying, it's such a hard thing to actually get, but just it's kind of about the process of just getting out there.
Sometimes I think, it's almost fun to go after something that you don't know if it's attainable. And I don't know anybody that's taken a Neil Guy bull with a bow in the middle of the summer spot and stalk. So just that component, you can't really lose. I mean, if you get one, it's incredible. If you don't, nobody was really expecting you to get one anyway. So, but just getting to see them and kind of learn the way that they are. I mean, they're a very strange animal as far as just, people have tried to bait them. They don't come to bait. I mean, you can't really pattern them. The only thing you could maybe do is find a water hole or something. But attempting something that's kind of right on the edge of what you think is possible, we didn't get it done this morning, but we might get it done this afternoon.
That's funny. Yeah, I like the idea of like an absurd hunt that it's just like, it's not even.
Well, it's just, really, I was looking at my dash on the way down here and it was flashing 108 degrees, and, you know, telling people. Honestly, I felt a little bit crazy just pulling my camo out the other day. I looked at my wife and I was like, she looked at me and she was like, what are you doing? And I said, I don't know, but you know what? There's not a lot of other people doing this right now. And I could sit there and watch TV, but where's the fun in that?
That's amazing, man.
Can you talk a little bit about, like the Nilgai animal? Like, what is it? Like, just kind of for anyone who doesn't know what that is.
Nilgai are a fascinating animal. They're originally from India, and I think the King Ranch actually brought them in sometime back in the 40s or 50s maybe, and I think the idea behind it was to have the meat is phenomenal, and it's very, very lean. They're probably similar to elk in size, anywhere, you know, bull's probably gonna be from 500 to 700 pounds. And they brought them over, I think, with the idea of it being a commercial meat type, you know, animal, and Nilgai didn't agree. They were a little bit crazy and they busted through fences and they just could never contain them. And so they've existed down here in this pocket of South Texas for, I mean, 60 years, and a lot of people, 70 years, a lot of people still don't know, even know they're here. A lot of people in Texas don't know they exist. And that's part of the fun of it to me, is that there's animals like that here in Texas that are huntable, and most people don't even know, they definitely don't know how to spell it. I don't know how to spell it, I don't think.
Could you talk a little bit just about some of the other wildlife? Because there was stuff popping out every 10 feet, you know?
One of the most fun things about the morning was just driving from the front gate back into the property and looking over and seeing, of course, it's the first, you know, first light, and the light's beautiful, and you've got animals out here just feeding out in the middle of these fields. And we've seen all kinds of stuff out here. I mean, but I think one of my favorite things was just, normally when I'm seeing deer, you know, they're hard-horned and it's hunting season and it's colder, but to see them in the full velvet and with their summer coats and out there just kind of, you know, sitting in the middle of these lush green fields and not really worried about us, that was kind of neat. We actually pulled up on a spot this morning where there was three deer out in the middle of a big stock, you know, looked like a stock tank of water, and out there just kind of browsing through. They were about knee deep and just kind of looked over at us and just kind of, all right, see you later. But this area down here has probably more different time. I mean, we saw coyotes today. There's an ocelot population here that's probably the highest of anywhere I know of, and a lot of people come to South Texas. South Texas is one of the major birding areas. I think a lot of people don't know that. There's more species of birds in South Texas, I think, than there are anywhere in the world.
Didn't know.
Yeah. People, it's kind of one of those crazy, you know, non-consumptive, but people come down here from all over the place and, you know, just sit and watch birds of all kinds, all different kinds.
Do you feel like it's your duty in some way to, like, spread the gospel?
I do. I think, especially with the way the world's changing, you know, and the way that, it's kind of like what I mentioned about earlier about working out. I mean, if things were the way that they were before, we probably wouldn't need to work out because we'd be getting enough physical activity with what we did on a daily basis. But times are changing, and sometimes you got to, you know, the reason we go to the gym and work out is because we know we need that physical activity. This is kind of the same thing. I mean, I can go to the grocery store and get meat, but I still have that calling to go out and be out in nature. And I think there's an innate desire in a lot of us to go out and be in the outdoors and, you know, get the most lean, organic form of protein that there is in the world. And just because you can go get it at the store doesn't mean that we don't need it. Same thing as physical activity.
How does someone get started if they didn't grow up around it?
Being in the outdoors, it's almost like something that you can't necessarily, hunting and fishing is not something that you can necessarily, I would say, watch a YouTube video and know how to do it. It's almost one of those rite of passage things. You have to go with somebody that's done it and that knows it and learn it from them. And I think that's one of the fun things about it, is you kind of just got to find somebody, grab them, and have them teach you. And it's a fun part of the process, too, because somebody taught me, you know. When I was growing up, I had grandparents that used to take me out and teach me things about it, and I knew nothing. And now I have little nieces and nephews that are growing up, and hopefully I'll have kids of my own one of these days, and I get to pass down that same information, and plus anything else I might have learned along the way.
Who do you hunt with now?
Hunting for me now is it's some of the most quality time that I get to spend with my friends and family. So, you know, there's just not a whole lot of time with the way the world's going now to sit there with another person, you know, for 2 or 3 hours or 4 hours in one place. And, you know, you're getting to watch stuff, but there's a lot of time just to be there and be present with people. And so I'll go out with my wife, I'll go out with, you know, family members, good friends, and sometimes, you know, just taking a kid or somebody that hasn't been a part of it and doesn't know. My all-time favorite is my grandmother, though. Anytime I get to take her out and spend some time with her, you know, days pass by fast and you got to take advantage of every chance you get.
What does she like to hunt?
My grandmother is a whitetail fanatic, and she also is a bass fishing nut, and pretty much anything. She pretty much sits and watches outdoor TV all day every day, and just kind of remembers, I think, the times and the highlights that she had, and envisions the next time that we're going to get together, and tells a bunch of stories to anybody that calls her or comes by and sees her in between.
We should have had her out here.
I know.
Oh, man. I mean,
we should
have been a little
much. Oh, it'd have been, she'd have been the star of the show. I mean, I'm serious. You never, I mean, she is like unbelievable. Loves it. She will be the first one out, like in the morning. And she'd stay out. We'd be out, you know, white bass and crappie fishing at night, 4 in the morning. She won't stop unless you make her stop. It's amazing. And she had never, before she met my granddad, she had never had anything to do with the outdoors, and just started going with him and fell in love with it. And then she would go by herself. She didn't care if he went or not. She'd go by herself.
So there really is a passing of the baton.
Yeah, you have to go with people, and you have to, you know, people that know how to do it have to be willing to take other people and invite them, and especially with as much private land as we have in Texas, you know, I think our landowners are great also about conservation and about knowing that, you know, we've got to manage our populations, and there's people that, you know, that would love to come out and do this, they just don't have the opportunity, and I hear, you know, ranchers and people all the time that bring people out and let them enjoy it and let them be a part of it, because at the end of the day, I think we're all wanting to see Texas wildlife and our huntable populations be as good as they can. I think we want to see as many people be involved in it and get to enjoy it as possible.
Excellent.
Do you have a photo of that picture of your grandma?
Oh, yeah.
With the deer?
Oh, yeah. It's documented.
You should send that to me so I could put it in.
Man, if she would be the best one to ever talk to in the world. She's like...
Should we get her on the phone?
Maybe.
Her little old lady voice. She's like, Jordan said what?
She's like my favorite person in the world, I think, probably.
Awesome.
Just sweet as she can be, but she will get out there. She will get after it out there and she will embarrass you with a fishing pole too. Like, you don't want to, if you're trying to be competitive, you don't want to go with her.
Has she put you in your place before?
Oh yeah, she's got the mojo. She's not. I mean, she'll just sit over there quietly. Oh, there's another one. Oh, there's another one. Oh, there's another one. And you're sitting there going, all right, this is ridiculous. She's 83. She shouldn't be beating me like this.
But you're competitive, so you gotta step up.
Yeah, you gotta figure it out.
Where's grandma right now? Where's
she lives in Abilene, Texas. They lived in Brownwood for a long time. My granddad was a quail guide, quail hunting guide. So he had a landscaping business, which was just about perfect. So he did his landscaping business until hunting season kind of rolled around, and then he would get to kind of taper that back a little bit. And then quail season, he had a bunch of dogs that he trained, and he would run quail hunts until the grass started growing again, basically.
This is unrelated, but have you heard of Roy Hines and his hunting dog?
Oh yeah, I know Roy Hines. Well, everybody, Roy Hines is like a folk legend in Texas, and everybody knows if there's anything that needs to be tracked, you call Roy Hines. At least once or twice a year, I'm with somebody, the only problem that Roy has is Roy can't be everywhere at one time during hunting season, because he probably gets 300 calls a day.
What's the deal? Why is this so special?
Well, he's got this, Roy's just, he's kind of developed a name for being able to, you know, track, and he's got some of the best dogs that, You know, I don't know what he does that's different than everybody else. And there's a bunch of people that do it, but everybody that ever gets into that situation calls Roy Hines. And he's kind of got he's almost got his own little brand in Texas of, like, you know, from, I don't know, he can't do anything else from September to February because he's getting 300 phone calls a day.
Wow. So amazing.
And now he's passing that along to his kids also. So now we'll call Roy, but a lot of times he'll send his sons out, and he's passed that baton to them, and they've you know, and they like to hunt and stuff themselves, but I think that's their own little niche in the whole outdoor community in Texas.
Why did you choose to get involved with the We Will Not Be Tamed campaign?
Well, to me, anything, I mean, I feel like the outdoors in Texas has been such a big part of my life. And so, and I've always been a really big supporter of Texas Parks and Wildlife and anything that they do. I really genuinely think that they're doing as good a job as they can possibly do for our people and for our wildlife. And so anything that they have going, if there's ever an opportunity for me to be involved in it, you know, I jump at the opportunity. It's almost kind of surreal to me to have something to do with it, and very blessed.
Thank you.
Could you sort of, you've mentioned a couple times, you know, always been around the outdoors ever since you were little. Could you just throw out a couple specific memories, just so, I don't know, so we can kind of picture what, like, is it you running around in the grass or, like, chasing after birds or I don't know what, something?
Yeah, I think, well, probably what started it all for me was getting to go fishing with my grandparents when I would go visit them on vacation, you know, and or just, we'd go see them probably two or three or four times a year, and it was just like, it was like something ignited in me when I was there with them and when I got to be a part of it that, you know, I couldn't wait for the next time to get to go see them. So anytime that opportunity came up, that's what I associated with them for whatever reason. And probably the most fun, you know, I had growing up starting off was getting to help my granddad guide quail hunts, and that kind of made an outdoor junkie out of me in some ways, because, you know, you're getting you're a little kid and you idolize your granddad, and you know, he was one of the top probably quail guides, and so he'd have a lot of celebrities and stuff come hunt with him and get to, you know, do that. So I'd every year he did this DRI celebrity quail hunt, and I'd get to go out there with him and run around. And I remember Chuck Yeager, the first guy that broke the speed of sound, and Will Clark, he was a baseball player for the Rangers, and all these guys. And I just remember thinking, man, all these people love this so much. It must be something pretty special.
That's cool.
Can I ask, like, just a football question?
Yeah.
I'm a big fan. Obviously, I never played college football, and I've never been hunting. But is there, like, you talked about tunnel vision. Is there, like, a different type of focus that you have to do, like, hunting versus, like, being in a 100,000-person stadium?
Yeah, I think it's just learning, you know, the main thing with sports and with hunting is just to learning how to improve and how to discipline yourself to accomplish something, you know, because the hunting side, you've got both ends of the extreme. You've got, you know, the scenario where, like we had this morning, where you've got, you know, a bunch of Neil guy out there that you're trying to figure out a way to spot and stalk to, and it's very intense, and it's very, you know, everything's heightened, you know, and for that 30 minutes or whatever it is. But you also got the other end of the extreme where you can be sitting there for 3 or 4 hours and have to kind of keep your mind into it and keep your mind occupied. And a lot of times with sports, the same way, you have to figure out how to keep yourself up during practice and how to, you know, film review and all that stuff. And then you also got to go out there during the game when the pressure's on and get it done, you know, in front of a whole lot of people. And so it's that same type of feeling. I mean, when you spent 45 minutes crawling across the field and you get that one split second where you have to step up and get it done under pressure, it's not a whole lot different than having to catch a pass in front of 101,000 people and however many million people on ESPN. It's just kind of all the same, I guess, in some ways.
Could you simplify that like parallel a tiny bit? Just maybe like football, you know, I get the same sensation, or, you know, just something like a little shorter, like a sentence or two.
Yeah, I think I get the same type of feeling where in the outdoors as I did in football sometimes, and just there's something about, you will see grown men absolutely just lose it, and you know, quivering and shaking, and it's similar for some reason to, you know, from a pressure standpoint, they've waited and they've practiced and they've shot, you know, thousands and thousands of arrows, and it all comes down to one moment, and the pressure's on, and you got to get it, you know, you got to get it right. And it's the same thing when you've gone through and caught 1,000 footballs, and you've, you know, gone through 1,000,000 practices, and all of a sudden it's that game time, and there's 101,000 people in the stands and a bunch of people watching on TV. It's all about kind of stepping up in that moment where the pressure's on.
That's cool. Yeah, that's really interesting, that specific moment, you know?
Yeah.
Because it does, everything you do dials into that.
Yeah.
Split second.
And it's not something that you get back, right? I mean, it's not like, oh, I messed that up, I can, you know, put myself right back in that same scenario. There's a lot that went into getting you to that point. So that's one of the biggest things to me, is when there's a lot on the table and there's a lot at stake, to be able to come through in that moment is one of the most fulfilling things I think there is in the world.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it's not a whole lot worse either when it doesn't, you know, when it doesn't go right. And I think that's one of the things about the outdoors, that it hooks people. And sometimes it's heartache, and sometimes it's, you know, you're on the top of the world. But from the standpoint of, you know, and a lot of it too is because we care so much about the animals. You know, we don't want to make a bad shot. We want to make the best, most ethical shot we can. And if something happens and you feel like, well, I didn't prepare enough, or I didn't, you know, this or that, it's bad. You know, you have to live with it. But at the same time, you know, the last thing you'd ever want is for that animal to suffer in any way. And so there's just a lot of reasons to have to be as prepared as possible and to be on top of your game. And when that moment happens, to have put yourself there 1,000 times in your mind before, especially with archery, because it's very situational, and you have to be, you know, you have to have visualized it a lot of times before the actual moment.
And so what does go through your mind when all this, everything that's lead up, like all the pressure leading up to this moment, and it doesn't go right? What's in your head?
When things, I mean, I've had some of the most just, and there's not a whole lot of things in the world that can do that to me, you know, but if I've poured myself into something and I've worked hard and it doesn't go the right way, or if I mess it up, you know, I've had some sleepless nights just thinking about, man, what could I have done different, or what should I have done different, or, you know, a lot of it's handling the pressure of it. A lot of people can't, it's crazy, but to see a lot of people can't handle it, or a lot of people realize after the fact that they didn't prepare the right way in the first place. That's probably the most common thing, and there's no worse feeling than to come away from a hunt and realize that the reason that you weren't successful is because it was your own fault and you weren't prepared. But it happens. But it teaches you about life too. I mean, it's that way in everything. You have to learn from your mistakes and come back a better person, and you know, that's what we all try to do.
Have you always been that disciplined, like in everything you do, that you're...
Well, let's be clear. My release didn't work today, so I don't think this was a little different. No, I think part of the reason for me, I felt like, if, you know, my dad always told me, if you want to accomplish things that not very many people accomplish, you have to be willing to do things that not many people are willing to do. And so for me in football, that was, you know, a lot of times when people were going out on Friday night or Saturday night, I remember a lot of times lifting weights at midnight on Saturday night and thinking, well, what am I doing? But I had to, you know, I had to be willing to pay a price that other people weren't willing to pay, because I didn't have, you know, I wasn't that much better than everybody else was. And it's the same thing with this. If you want to, you know, you can be as good as you want to be in the outdoors. A lot of people, a lot of the guys I do this with are competitive, and they want to be the best, and they want that for the animals also. So I think, you know, practicing and making sure that you're prepared is a big thing, not only from the standpoint of your own personal validation, but also, you know, for conservation and management.
That's great. Is there anything else y'all want to add, or are we?
Yeah, I just want to get a little bit of the backstory, just to have it.
Oh, just a little coverage.
Because you're from Burnett. Did you grow up in Burnett?
Yeah, I actually grew up in Abilene. My dad was a football coach, so we moved around quite a bit.
Could you do a quick overview of, like, I'm from this, I grew up playing football, my dad coached me, I played football at UT, and then I went on to do hunting and whatever.
Yeah, so I grew up in Abilene, Texas. My dad was a football coach, and we moved around a little bit. Ended up going to high school in Burnett, Texas, which is about an hour northwest of Austin. Was recruited and played at University of Texas under Mack Brown, and then was drafted, played 3 or 4 years in the NFL, kind of got beat up, I played slot receiver, and ended up having the opportunity to do something in the outdoor world. So jumped in and started hosting an outdoor TV show and did that for several years, and now still doing that some, and also doing some things in ranch real estate, which is a blast because I get to, you know, be out in creation and habitat and looking at wildlife and everything else.
Cool. Good.
Yeah, I think that's good. Is there anything else that you want to tie in about, like, just your life in football?
Let me say one more thing on the archery side. One of the things I've learned, definitely in football, and it relates to football, it relates to life, and it relates to the outdoors, is most people don't really put themselves in the scenario that they're going to be in, or something harder, so that they're ready when the time comes. And people spend a lot of money and a lot of time, but they don't really prepare themselves. That's one of the things I had to learn the hard way with, especially when it comes to archery, is you're not going to be, when the time comes, you're not going to be sitting there in perfect light from 25 yards, standing up in a perfect situation, and everything's, you know, I had to start realizing, like, okay, in the real world, if I'm spotting and stalking, I might be on one knee, I might be contorted, I'm not out of practice that way, you know, and so I'd go out at last light and practice and shoot targets where the light's not great, because you realize, well, my peep sight, I might not be able to see it as well as I can in the middle of the day when I'm practicing. So going through those kind of things and actually thinking about what could happen, and you make it harder on yourself in practice than it is in the real thing, and that's how you come in when that big moment is there and become successful, and a lot of people just don't do that.
Yeah, it's like a whole life philosophy.
Well,
down into one activity.
Yeah, because you don't realize it until it's too late. You get there, you get in the scenario, and you're like, I've never been here before. I don't know if I can do it, you know. And if I've sat there and practiced, you know, and a lot of times, in football, I put an eye patch on one eye while I'm catching balls because I know I have one dominant eye, one non-dominant eye. But then I, you know, catch a bunch of balls and then move it to the other eye, and I train the other eye. And just doing stuff like that and thinking proactively will make a huge difference, and it carries over to life, and it carries over in the outdoors, and especially archery is such a specialized thing, and it's such a there's so many things that can go wrong that if you put yourself in the scenario where this could happen, I'm going to practice it, and then when the time comes and it pays off because of what you did, that feels good. Yeah, that gets into a lot of, yes, it gets into a lot of things, but one of the things I love about our state and I love about Texas Parks and Wildlife is I think that they're thinking proactively, and there's such a difference between doing things proactively and reactively, and that, to me, that's the difference between success and failure, is if you're sitting there doing things in a reactive fashion, and, oh, this happened, so we're going to have to, you know, make these decisions, as opposed to thinking about some of the things that could happen with the landscape and with land ownership and with people moving in, and there's just all kinds of variables, and I think that's a big part of what we all want to, you know, we all want to see this state and the wildlife in it and the outdoors be as good as they can be, and I want to, you know, that's one thing I love about Texas Parks and Wildlife is I think that they're thinking proactively about all kinds of different things and game, whether it be, you know, harvest tags and game management to, you know, bighorn sheep and what they're doing out there in West. There's just a lot of things that they're doing that they don't have to do that way. And I think that's part of the reason why we have such an incredible resource in this state for wildlife.
It's nice. Cool. Anyone, anything else? You good? All right, that's a wrap. Thank you, Jordan.
Cool.
This is great.
Awesome.
Texas Parks and Wildlife Podcast is brought to you by Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, supporting high-impact conservation projects across the state. Find out how you can help at tpwf.org.